art and public policy. We've spoken quite a bit over the last number of sessions about the role of art in religious life. Last week, we began asking questions about halachic tensions, ethical questions in the exposure to the visual arts. This week, we'll be asking what role should art play in the public sphere, in the national ethos. And we'll be doing that by looking at Rav Kook's rather well-known letter to Dr. Boris Schatz, who was the founder of the Bezalel School of Art here in Jerusalem. It happens that, completely by coincidence, this is the 100th anniversary of Bezalel, celebrating its centennial. There is, at the Israel Museum, a very interesting exhibit about Schatz, who was the founder of Bezalel and the founder of what apparently was called the Bezalel Museum. Connected to the school was a museum, which was the forerunner of what today is the Israel Museum. We'll have a link up on our website to that interesting exhibit, some of the information is online, if anyone is interested in the history of the school or of Schatz himself. He was also a rather interesting figure, and completely by coincidence, in today's Haaretz Book Review is a review of a new biography connected apparently to this exhibit at the Israel Museum, biography of Dr. Schatz, of Dr. Boris Schatz. But in around 1903, Schatz meets with Herzl in Europe. He was the head of an art school, of an artist school in Bulgaria, and he meets with Herzl, who's passing through town, and he gets Herzl ignited on this idea of creating a school of art which would revitalize the Jewish creative impulse, which had been retarded by the many years of Galut, synthesize that with the great European traditions of art, but to do it in Eretz Yisrael and somehow revive the spirit of Eretz Yisrael, of Jewish creativity, both Ashkenazi as well as Mizrahi, as well as the Eastern traditions of the artistic traditions of the Sephardim. These were some of the things they did. In 1906, they found the Bezalel School, and this letter from Rav Kook is written about 2 years later, yeah. 1908. And that's what we're looking at. It is in the first volume of the Igrot HaRi'iyah, of Rav Kook's collected letters, beginning on page 203. Rabbi Sinclair.
Thanks, Rabbi Sinclair. So we're going to be looking at this letter from Rav Kook to Boris Schatz. And it's worthwhile to say something about Rav Kook's letters in general, particularly as they compare to the rest of his writing. Most of Rav Kook's writings, as we've said, were edited from his personal spiritual notebooks and journals. And there, he has no problem with taking an idea or thought and then expressing it in the most sharpest and boldest way that he can. And he's writing mostly for himself there. This is not what he does in his letters. His letters are always to somebody and written at a particular time about a particular subject, usually in response to a particular query or question or a halachic shayla. And Rav Kook's always thinking about who he's writing to and where and why. And so in his letters, then, the way he writes is much more balanced. He rarely takes an uncompromising view on a particular issue. He puts different sides. He balances one point against another. He writes his letters as a rav, giving advice and guidance to people. And so in the sessions which we've done until now, we've often seen Rav Kook take very clear and apparently uncompromising stands on particular principles. Here, he brings together a lot of the considerations which we've seen in our previous discussions and shows how they may be balanced against one another in the context of advice to a particular person, Borishat, at a particular time, the birth of the Batalos Kuvar. So the letter is 3.5 pages long, and therefore I will summarize it mostly outside, referring from time to time to what the letter actually says. So Cook starts off with the basic preamble about the times that he's living in and says, it's very bad times. There's darkness and tohu vavohu and pogroms and riots and massacres against Jews in Europe. But the revival in Eretz Yisrael is one of the points of light on the Jewish scene. And among those points of light is the revival of Jewish art in Eretz Yisrael, exemplified by the foundation of the Batal School. And Rav Kook says a lot of people are looking at this development with great anticipation. And to describe what this revival of art means, he gives an extended metaphor about a little girl called Shoshana. This is the top of page 204 now, who's deathly ill. Rav Kook goes into vivid detail about her cheeks are white and her lips are blue and she's gripped with fever and she's convulsing and shuddering and the doctors have all but given up hope for her. When suddenly she opens her eyes and manages to stammer out the words, Ima Ima Habuba Tnini Habuba. Give me my dolly, please, mummy. And everyone's tremendously excited about the fact that little Shoshana has managed to say something. And it's a very good omen for her recovery, and they call in the doctor, and the doctor confirms that yes, indeed, she seems to have turned the corner, and looks like things are getting better for little Shoshana, and she's going to grow up, and she's going to be a big girl and a woman, and event then she goes and she asks for medicine, and she asks for food, and she asks for soup, and she asks for a pen and paper, and books and toys, but everybody remembers that the first thing she asked for when she opened her eyes was her little booba, her dog. Dog, sorry. And Rav Kook says, well, this is the situation of Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, is the Shoshana Tal Amakim, as the lily of the valleys, as Shir HaShirim says, in the middle of page 204, and is being smitten by this long and painful sickness of Galut, and many, many people have all but given up hope of her ever recovering. And then suddenly there are signs of life stirring from in Yerushalayim. And among these very early signs of life are Umanot and Melechet Machshevet, art and different crafts. And people say, Ulay ein hadavar b'yito, maybe it's premature, Yomu Balei HaCheshbon Yeshnam Tzrichim Kedumim, there are things which are more pressing. Hence, Ulai V'Ulai Yesh V'Yesh. Yeah, well, Cook says that's true, but Ein Hachinami, that the demand for art and creativity was one of the first stirrings of revival in Eretz Yisrael. Haba Milev Baneha comes from the heart of her children, and therefore it's precious as a sign of revival and an omen of hope and salvation and comfort. So that's Rav Kook's metaphor about the significance of this revival of art. I think there's room to read this in two different ways. The way most people read it, and the way I prefer to read it, is that Rav Kook is saying that, you know, art is the revival of Jewish art is a very precious thing, because it's one of the first stirrings of renewed life in Eretz Yisrael. You could perhaps read it as saying that Rav Kook's saying, look, in fact there are more important things, that there are things to be concerned for first. But because it was one of the first stirrings of life in the renewed Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael, we should value it and nurture it. You could read it like that, but there is an element of irony when Rav Kook says, ulai, ulai, yesh, v'yesh. But I prefer to read it at face value, that Rav Kook is genuinely excited about this development. And then Rav Kook goes on and says, and it's not just that this is an ot chayim she'einenu rak ot reik mechol tochen mamashi. It's not that this is just simply a sign with no inner content to it, but it actually does have very substantive content to it, which is that a lot of people are going to be able to hopefully earn a living from this. And this is one of the declared aims of the Vatara school, that it would train craftspeople who would be able to sell their wood carvings of Yerushalayim and their silver candlesticks and all the other things they made to the floods of tourists who are expected to inundate Eretz Yisrael sometime soon. And Rav Kook says that's great. He does not disdain the arts and crafts side of the Bezalel project. If there are Jews who are going to be able to earn a living from it in Eretz Yisrael, then that's all to the good. It's hard enough then to earn a living in Eretz Yisrael. And then Rav Kook says, in his inimitable way, he says, you know, the wonderful things that you're doing may embolden me to say a few words in your ear, and I'm sure that you'll take it in the right spirit, Rav Kook says. Rav Kook really knew how to make people feel good about themselves before offering really serious criticism. And he says, these words which I'm going to say, he says at the top of page 205, are, they come from a different perspective. L'chora acher legamri me'otor ha'ofek shel yitzirah shel ha'yofi ha'umanut. Different perspective from that of the world of creativity and aesthetics and art. Ofek ha-rabanut, the perspective of the rabbinate. Avam mekaveh anish adavarim yu l'toilet. Well, I hope these things are going to be useful anyway. So, Rav Kook's gentle advice begins by saying that in the history of world art, there's been an impulse very often of unbounded paganism. And that's something we have to be very careful of. In the sixth line down at the end, it says, Nisharim anu mishikaron v'hafraza, v'afil avrim yoten nisgavim v'ne'elamim. We have got to beware of intoxication, even in things which are very high and exalted. And you may remember that Rav Kook used that word shikaron last week, in his introduction to Shir HaShirim. He refers to the shikaron, with the intoxication which art can induce, particularly when it borders on the erotic, and that a Jewish artist has to know where to draw the boundaries there. And then he says, you know, we've got to be guided by Tzedek. And he says that even so, that Tzedek is obviously a virtue. There was a pasuk which said, "Al tehit tzadik harbe," don't be overly righteous. And although chachma is clearly a very good thing, wisdom, yet there's also a pasuk which says, "Al tichachem yoter, tichachem yoter." Don't be too clever. Well, Rav Kook is saying that any virtue, however important it is, can't be set up as the only and ultimate ideal. And I think in this he's taking a clear stand against the ideal of art for art's sake, which was prevalent in the 19th century and goes back to Kant's critique of judgment, of art being and are one of the ultimate values in its own right. And Rav Kook said, no, not even tzedek or chachma can be ultimate values in their own right. They all have to be balanced by other things. And certainly art cannot. Art is not an excuse for overrunning the boundaries of Torah and mitzvot, not to mention good taste. Ma'olam lo nitmakeh l'diyah pratit echad b'midazu. We can never be sold to or addicted to one particular partial idea. Not art, not tzedek, or not chachma. We always have to be aware that ideals and virtues, however important they are, always take their place in a constellation of other values against which they have to be balanced. And so Rav Kook says, there need to be limits and checks against this kind of the possibility of the intoxicatory aspect of art running out of control. And he says that for us, the limits only need to be very, very delicate. He said, it's enough that there be a suga v'shoshanim, a fence of roses, quote from Shir HaShirim, that almost a symbolic boundary which shows that there is a danger here, there is something to be careful about, and the fact that there's a merely symbolic boundary pointing out the danger should be enough for Knesset Yisrael to take the appropriate precautions and beware of overstepping that boundary. It's enough that it just be a Chinese wall, Rav Kook says, an almost artificial partition, but one which you can see and recognize and will cause you to stop. So then, Rav Kook goes on and says that given the tendency to paganism and even idolatry, which you sometimes see in world art, Jewish art, which is guided by emet hamada'it hamusarit, by truth and morality, has a very important potential role to play. Because he says, about six lines down into the second paragraph on 205. He says that Jewish art potentially has a world significant role to play because it is and must be guided by this resistance to idolatry and therefore has the potential to redeem art and the aesthetic as such from the crudeness of idolatrous tendencies. And Rav Kook goes on to say that all through Jewish tradition, in his interpretation, you have this guiding ambivalence. B'yamim docheh u'b'smol makarevet. That pushing away art with the right hand, but drawing it closer with the left hand. And he quotes, we have the very clear prohibitions in the Aseret HaDibrot against making an image, lo ta'asu l'ti Elohei kesef hei zahav, lo ta'asu l'chem, lo ta'asu l'cha peser. And yet, on the other hand, you have the command to Bezalel, which is the biblical Bezalel, given clearly and wholeheartedly to use all his artistic and creative skills in order to make the Mishkan as a dwelling place for Hashem. But Tzara, who we saw in a couple of the Agata, which we looked at in Masechet Brachot, they're serving as a source of inspiration for Rav Kook to define what the characteristics of the ideal Jewish artist should be. So when Rav Kook, having said, pointed out this danger of this tendency to paganism and idolatry in art, and having said that Jewish art needs to be guided, needs to have limits, but the limits need only to be a hedge of roses, something almost symbolic which will serve to show that there is a danger and but which should be enough to cause the artist to take note and to beware. Well, Cook then says what, in his view, the limits are, in his halachic view, this is. How does this translate into psak? And well, Cook says as follows, that after the victory that Judaism was won over idolatry, and we saw that in the passage on imagination, which we wrote in Orot, where Rav Kook interprets, describes the struggle over many centuries to tame the idolatrous impulse, which finally was victorious at the end of the Bayit Rishon period, as expressed by the Gemara in Yoma, Daf Samach Tet. So Rav Kook says that after that effective victory in over idolatry, that there's only a thread of a prohibition is necessary to remind us that there is a danger there and that one must guard against it. And so what Rav Kook says is that the thread of halakhic prohibition which remains, based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Mem Dalad, is kol ha-patsufim mutarim chutz mi-patsuf adam. All faces may be depicted except for the face of a person. And Rav Kook qualifies that a step further. He says, amnam rak patsuf adam v'tmuna boletet v'shlema. It's only a face of a human being in relief, that is in sculpted form, which is prohibited. Another not in drawing. The gam ze yeshnam dachei bina, and even in that case there are ways of addressing the problem halachically. For example, lehe'azer al yedei chevrat oman or ze she'ena ben brit. For example, Rav Kook says that you could get help from someone who's in your company of artists who's not Jewish to do that bit of the work for you. Well, Rav Kook's saying there is a halachic prohibition on depicting a human face, which he narrows down to what seems to him the smallest practical area possible, and yet it's important that the prohibition remain.
Even though we can get a Shabbos guy to do it for us.
Even though we can, for all practical intents and purposes, or almost all practical intents and purposes, get around it. It's still important that there is that issur there. Why? Amnam, he says about 10 lines down, Reish Vav, Rak nekudak tana tesha'er mikol hakav ha'aruch. Just this fine point remains from the whole long thread of halachic restrictions on the depiction of human forms. Aval mal rabu machshavoteha. But there's a tremendous amount of important thought behind this. Hatemunot hamayuchodot le'elilim. Because these are the images which are particular to idolatry. They were very big on human faces representing the divine. Bein ha'olam he'eli ha'va v'ha'oveh, in the world of idolatry, both in the past and in the present, ubein ha'olam ha'notzri, This was also clearly the depiction of the human face, and calling it a god was, and is, characteristic of the Christian world. Titzaev Knesset Yisrael v'lo tuchal et Satan. This is an abomination to Knesset Yisrael, and this is something that we can't bear. And so now Rav Kook turns to Boris Schatz and says, therefore, in your setting up on this enormously important work, this project of an art school in Eretz Yisrael, it's important that you should tovdi ha'aguda ha'nichbada galui l'chol ha'alam ha'no'or ha'evri ha'klali she'yaseh kol ma'aseha otam ha'mitkansim ba'oto ha'mishol ha'tzah שבו יפגשו רגש האומה, הדת והאמונות, על פי חפץ האומה ושאיפתה הכללית, לראות ביחד, בייחוד בעיר מסוף תקוותה, עוד זה כל יקרתה, וחוסן אדם מקדשה, על פי נראה את זה important bit, על פי הוראת חכמי ישראל, גאוני ארץ ישראל המפורסמים באומה. Therefore, Rav Kook said, it's important that you, the Bezalel school, declare to the people in Eretz Israel and Yerushalayim that you are operating under the authority and the guidance of the Go'onim of Eretz Israel, under rabbinic authority. It's because there is this danger and there are halakhic restrictions on what an artist can do, even though Rav Kook is prepared to narrow them down to the minimum possible as he sees it, it's still important that you declare that you're under rabbinic authority. And then he goes on to say that if you do this, you can be sure that your enterprise will succeed, and there will be no obstacles and no problems, and your work will only bring glory to Am Yisrael and to the revival of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael, and you'll continue lahamshich gam ken chanichim rabim mibnei Tzion lemelachot hamechubot halalu mianafim harabim mishpatim meitz hachayim sheyatziyo haumanot, and you'll bring droves of students in Eretz Yisrael to all the different branches of art, and you'll continue to encourage people and inspire people with this sign of the renewal of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael. So there Rav Kook has brought together quite a few of the different points which we've seen. On the one hand, the Zionist significance of art as a sign of the revival of Jewish life here. On the other hand, the potential danger of art, the shikaron, the intoxication, the pagan influences which can get out of control. And then said, in practice there must be some, there are halakhic restrictions, even though in practice he's prepared to make them minimal, and therefore you have to declare that you're under halakhic authority, and if you do, then your work will go from strength to strength. Schatz wrote a reply to Rav Kook, which was very short, and it seems to me, at least, to be missing the point, and perhaps deliberately so. I don't know. This is what Schatz wrote: "Ein anachnu osim et zeh," meaning porcelain statues. We don't do that. Lo Hashem kach bati le'eretz Yisrael. ולא לשם כך יסדתי את בצלל בכדי שאנו נעשה פסלים לגויים. That's not why I came to Eretz Israel to make statues for Goyim. I did enough of that in Bulgaria. עוסקים אנחנו בלכת מחשבת בעבודת האמנות הקדושה, מעלים אנחנו את היופי העולמו של הקודש ברוך הוא, את יופי ארץ ישראל, את עברנו הגדול ואת גדולנו.
In Bulgaria,
yeah,
Schatz was the, he had like a royal appointment.
Right.
He was the
court sculptor.
He was a court sculptor.
Prince Ferdinand of Bulgaria.
Very, very, I see. You've done your homework, Rabbi Sinclair.
Thanks to your resources, Rabbi Sachs. So he said, I came here to add Kedushah to Eretz Yisrael and to depict the beauty of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world and of Eretz Yisrael, that's what I'm doing here. And what's more, we're doing depicting stories from the Tanakh and from the Midrashim, and the whole thing, I'm sure, is only going to be a Kiddush Hashem to a Kiddush Hashem and an enhancement of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael. So Schatz takes what Rav Kook is saying as being a point about the specific halachic restriction on sculpture, and says, don't worry, we don't do sculpture. But he avoids saying, as Rav Kook wants him to, that the Batala school is going to be under halachic authority. Seems to me that Rav Kook's point was not the narrow one about sculpture, but it was about, in general, recognizing the potentially problematic aspects of art, the need for halakha to regulate them, and therefore the importance in general of recognizing rabbinic authority. And that issue Boris Schatz avoids. Any comments on that?
I always found the letter very interesting because it expresses a certain point of view that I can't even begin to imagine that Boris Schatz could have understood. Besides the specific question that Rabbi Sinclair asks, we're talking about people who come from worlds that are so different that it's hard to understand what idea could have bridged the gap between them.
Although Schatz did grow up in a religious home. Schatz's father was like a Malamed in a Cheder or something, and he himself learned in yeshiva, you know, in Vilna before going off to, do other things, like being the court sculptor to Prince Ferdinand in Bulgaria. So they did come from, they were coming from very different places, but...
Someone who becomes non-religious, or was, grew up in a religious home, became non-religious, but even though he may be able to make reference to some of the code words of the religious community, certainly doesn't see that community in the way Rav Kook sees it. Now, both of them were looking primarily at a non-religious community that was awakening to strengths that it had. And Boris Schatz belonged to the Herzliyan school that said we can do it, and that by doing it we will fulfill ourselves in some way. But that you don't need any of the trappings of religion in order either to do it or to make it worthwhile or meaningful. Whereas Rav Kook looked at the world as being only religious. I mean, only the spirit in the world was about being close to God. So he had to translate everything into a positive step in that direction. I mean, that was the only goodness that there was. He wasn't prepared to say that a Jew could either be religious or an artist. But he probably knew very well that the world of the artist was not a world that was fettered or bounded or limited in the same way that halacha limits the way we live. I mean, that's who we are. We're the people who recognize limits in every area, which is what produces our notion of Kodesh. Ad Kan is permitted, Mikan Vahala is forbidden, whereas artists, at least the way the romantic notions that Rav Kook expresses, artists find the limits within themselves, and in order to create the light within themselves, they have to live a very unfettered, unlimited, unstructured kind of life. At least many artists seem to feel that way. So you're talking about two worlds, and here's Rav Kook actually trying to harness it in somehow, to sort of say, well, you could be with us, you could still be with us, because we can see the greater truth in what you are doing, and that is projecting this light without falling prey to idolatry. Whereas the other side says, who's idolatry? And light is me. I mean, there's no limiting force. I'm totally ego-centered. I mean, it's just me and what I can do and what I can produce. I'm not working for anybody. I'm not even working for Zionism. I'm working for, I mean, the closer you get to the artist, I would imagine the more he is himself. And in a world where there is only himself, whereas Rav Kook lived in a world where there was only Torah, and that everything could fit into that Torah, and therefore he writes to Schatz and tells him that he thinks it's a great idea, but this is the idea, and Schatz doesn't have a clue about what that idea is, probably because he grew up in the way that he grew up, that he could use the words Kodesh and Chol and Avodah Zarah. He uses those words. Of course, we're not there, we're someplace else, but of course they're not any place that that Rav Kook wanted them to be. And today there's an interesting experimentation going on. I don't know if Rav Kook would be happy about it or less happy about it, where people who are religious, who accept halachic limits, are themselves trying to be artists, which means that in some way they want to be true to the light within themselves, and not just graphic or computer-generated graphic artists or craftsmen, which, you know, okay, they might be considered artists in some kind of constellation, but to be real, meaning look deeply inside of yourself and find something that you can say or do which doesn't necessarily contradict the halachic position. But I'm not sure what the direction is, whether this is going to be a rejuvenation of religious values which determine the demarcation between Kodesh and Chol, or a lifting of those boundaries and kind of making the boundaries, at least from time to time, almost optional, so that the artist can do what the artist does, in which case there will just be another great, probably great conflagration between the non-artists and the artists, who will not succeed in integrating themselves into the traditional religious culture, but not because they will do it or won't do it, but because they will claim that there's another light, that there's some other sanctity which they can grab onto, which those people who declare the distinction between sacred and profane don't have any notion about it at all. And that's what Rav Kook and Schatz are talking about, I think. Rav Kook wants to emphasize the fact that we really know all that there is to know about the light and the sanctity and the Kedusha. And it's true that art might be integrated into that, but that could be its only justification. Whereas artists say that art creates its own light, which is independent of and disconnected from any other notion in history of light. And so Rav Kook, who was masterful, I think, in this way of thinking about things, wanted to bring everything in the world into his camp. But he wasn't creating a parody between his camp and the camp of the artist. He was saying that in my world, there's room for the artist, but there's no room in my world for the world of the artist.
no room for an artist who's not part of my world.
Well, there might be as a kind of intermediate step. You know, you might say, okay, there was a war and everything fell apart and we ended up as an artist. But as long as we understand that the goal is to integrate art into the our view of Kodesh and Chol, that's all right. You know, we might be able to put up with an artist from time to time. But he has no ultimate value. He only has ancillary value to the man. If I had to choose either the idea of Kodesh and Chol as depicted by limits and boundaries, or the idea of light depicted by the artist, of course I would take the Kodesh and the Chol and jettison the artist in a moment. Mm-hmm. But Rav Kook, he said that it's possible to absorb the artist, to bring him in, and to integrate his light, and that was his remarkable pluralistic stance.
And within the outer limits of Isser v'Heter and Halacha, to be as flexible as possible.
If that'll do it, I mean, if that will produce the result, but flexible doesn't always produce the desired result.
But it's not clear to me that Rav Kook is writing this this line that, you know, in terms of really a very lenient ruling while still obviously maintaining in principle the issue of graphic representations of the human.
I mean, halakhically liberal?
Halakhically.
I think Rabbi Yaakov Emden said the same thing.
Others did as well, but in other words, he's taking the lenient stance, not merely as some kind of curative device to say, well, you know, it will come and then we'll... But because he's arguing, in some ways, Rav Kook is the more artistic of the two in the exchange. Not in some, in many ways. Because he's saying, no, you have to be doing the art, and the art has to be part of the, within the Ohala Shel Torah, because it has something to do, it has a task to play as we revitalize this nation and this land. And Shatz is saying, no, don't worry, we're only a trade school. We're going to be producing tchotchkes and postcards and ceramic tiles for the visiting, you know, tourists. One of the interesting things that I read in this review of this biography is that Shatz organized an aliyah of Taimani Jews, both because they were fabulous craftsmen, particularly with fine metalwork, but also because they were cheap laborers. He thought that he could get cheap laborers and they would compete with the cheap Arab laborers in turn of the century, Eretz Yisrael, sitting in Yericho and other places, who were producing all of the tchotchkes and the metalwork and the other things that you know, your grandmother may have had in her house, that someone may have brought her on a visit from pre-state Palestine, and mm-hmm. he helped organize an aliyah of Taimani Jews, of Yemenite Jews, who could serve as these kinds of craftsmen. This is a different role mm-hmm. from art than that aspired to by Rav Kook.
Yeah, I think you put the finger on something important about. Rav Kook is willing to narrow down the limits to the minimum possible, but saying there must be limits, and the artist is saying, no, there's no limit except my own, the demands of my own creativity. And it's interesting to compare this letter to the story we said told last week about Agnon, where Rav Kook didn't try to control Agnon's creativity, and appears to have acknowledged after the fact that the artist's creative impulses may sometimes overrun the boundaries of halakha. And he's willing to see that happen to an individual, but I think he's not willing to sanction an institution which is going to operate outside the bounds of halakha. And throughout his life he continually fought the formation of Zionist institutions which were consciously cut off from Zion, from Halakha and Jewish tradition. He wanted to try and somehow keep them all inside, and however loose a way however loosely that was possible, but he couldn't agree to Zionist institutions which were cut off from Torah and Halakha. I think that's his approach here also.
On that on the point of the story that we that you related last week about Agnon, our intrepid listener Rabbi Chaim Morrison pointed out that in Simcha Raz's collection of stories or biography of Rav Kook called Malachim Kivnei Adam, which I think has been translated by one of our Atid fellows, by Moshe Lichtman, I think it was translated as An Angel Among Men. So in the Hebrew version on page 368, which Rabbi Morrison tells me corresponds to page 400, he mentions the story about Agnon bringing some questionable piece of writing to Rav Kook, bashfully bring this questionable piece of writing that had some kind of erotic motif in it, and Rav Kook says, well, it's batal b'shishim, it's nullified. So Rav Kook's formulation is even stronger than the way we presented it, in terms of not merely that it's batal, but apparently Rav Kook quoted a prima godim that says, yesh shenafla tipa shel isur l'toch heter sheyesh shishim kenegdo. As the batel b'shishim, when one drop of milk falls into a larger quantity, 60 times larger quantity of meat, so then it is cancelled, according to the principle of batel b'shishim. As a heter marviach min ha'iser, the permitted substance profits, gains, grows through the addition of the prohibited. Sheyesh achshav shishim ve'echad chalakim. Heter. Because now there are 61 parts. 60 parts permitted, 1 part forbidden. The forbidden is cancelled, but now you have 61 pieces. 61 parts. And so that the heter itself grows, gains from the presence of the Isser. That's a stronger formulation. Kach etzlecha, so said Rav Kook to Agnon. Afilu nofel l'toch sifrecha eze davar shel isur hu batel b'shishim v'naseh heter hu she'amar ha-heter marviach miha isur. So it's a rather strong...
The interesting thing, I think, about that story is that Rav Kook certainly knew that what he was saying was wrong. It was wrong, because the only time that bittul works is if the isser disappears.
Yeah.
But here the guy...
Here the eroticism is still on page 26.
Right here. So to say that it disappeared, I think that Rav Kook was also a Rav.
Yeah, it's
and,
a doubt.
And with the Rabbana, even the Rav Kook generally was machmir in the issues that we know about. He was machmir about Chaliva and Shabbat, then he was machmir about women voting. And really, in fact, he was pretty machmir about the Shemitah as well, because he said that the Heter, which was based on an earlier Heter, did not originate with him, but it was only for one Shemitah, and it would have to be reinvestigated each time. So I think that he was a machmir, lahalaka, when the question was a public stance. But when it comes to people, I mean, he knew that Agdon didn't come to ask him whether he should write or whether he should publish this. It was sort of, it happened that maybe Agdon felt embarrassed about showing it to Rav Kook. So Rav Kook said something, but Rav Kook's position on halacha was very, very solid. And did not allow, he didn't say, let's make lenient halachot, and that's going to get people in. I don't think he said that. I think what he said was, I see the goodness in the human effort. And because of that, I'm willing to say that it will ultimately be integrated into our system. But he would never say, I see the goodness of the human effort, and therefore we can ignore our system or forget about the halacha. in this area. I don't think he would ever say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This issue which we've brought out of whether the artist is willing to accept any external limitation on his or her creativity, Ralph Cook demanding that they do, and Schatz avoiding the issue and apparently refusing to accept that, I find dramatized in quite an interesting way by a picture I found in the exhibition on halachically inspired art called Hamadil Bein Kodesh Lachol, which was and perhaps still is going on at Bar-Ilan University. There's a booklet about it, edited by David Sperber.
David Sperber.
And there's a piece which is bringing on page 25 by an artist called Ruth Kestenbaum, which has a duff of Gemara from a Bozar on one side, with the words which Ralph Cook quoted in his letter, "B'chol ha'patzufim mutarim chutz mipatzuf adam." They all faces may be represented except for the faces of a human being. And on the other side, you have a human face staring at the page of Gemara with a mixture of fear and fascination and astonishment, directed at the prohibition to depict the human face. And of course, it's an acknowledgement of the halakha, and of course it's also a transgression of the halakha as well, at least as it's usually understood, not as Ralph Cook understands it. Ralph Cook would have said this is mutter, but as the artist understands it, it's an act of transgression against the halakha by depicting the face opposite the Gemara. It's recognizing that the halacha is there, that the halacha has authority, but at the same time, the artist's difficulty in accepting the restrictions on her art.
This piece of art, you can click on the link from our website. The piece is called Lekro Panim. The artist is Ruth Kestenbaum Ben-Dov, and from this website that has her work on it, I discovered that, first of all, the face is, it's a self-portrait. That's the mm-hmm. artist herself. Mm-hmm. She herself is Datia. She mm-hmm. was born in America in 1961, came to Israel as a teenager, studied in Bezalel, and now lives someplace up in the Galil. You can view her other works and some articles about her work on this site linked from our site.
But this exhibition is the kind of flourishing of religiously inspired art, which Ralph Cook might have hoped for when he was addressing Bezalel, which certainly didn't happen then and didn't happen for many decades afterwards, but perhaps is beginning to happen now.
What do you think of that piece of art by Bravender? You don't care for it, do you?
I'm not sure. It seems to me that it's a text. And I don't think that what it means is I am an idolater. I think it means perhaps what does the Gemara mean? Like, you know, you have a Gemara that says face is bad, and you have a face that looks quite angelic actually, or pleasant, or certainly not offensive, oppressive, and unsightly. So I think it's it's a question.
Interesting.
How are we to understand the Gemara? Here's a face.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it represents an interesting way of asking the question. It's a kind of a trigger.
What do you think the emotion on her face is? Is it terror? Is it?
No, I don't think. I think it's wonder.
Like, what could that possibly mean?
Hmm.
Which I think if she knew that the Gemara had already said that idolatry had been done in, that it would be self-explanatory.
Hmm.
But I think the vision has to be a bit more substantial.
Yeah.
It's an interesting presentation, but yeah. I put it in the category of a trigger for conversation.
Yeah.
Not so much as an arrangement that is so special, new, and interesting that it could be classified as art with a Jewish theme.
Mm.
This is just a Jewish text, but the pointer is the face.
Mm.
So maybe that's good, but I'm not sure that it's art without trying to define what art is.
Yeah.
But there must be a difference in art and a teaching tool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's worked as a trigger for conversation.
Yes, yes.
That's an interesting question. We discussed quite a bit the aesthetic and the creative impulse, but from the point of view of the consumer of art, the viewer of art, why one thing resonates with me and a different thing resonates with you, and a third thing altogether may or may not resonate with Rabbi Bravender, is a question we might want to explore in the future. You, Rabbi Bravender, you're not such a... Although you have great appreciation for the great works of art, what sometimes is what's generically called Jewish art doesn't particularly catch your fancy.
Well, it is what it is, but it's usually ornamental art or, you know, a becher and a holder for a candle, and Havdalah is like a combination between something that's useful and something that's pleasant. But I don't think that art is defined with either of those words. I mean, art is an expression, a profound expression of the human spirit, and what makes an artist special is that he has some vehicle with which to express what's inside of him, and in a way that is communicable. It may be often that the artist himself doesn't know that he's doing that, but it's certainly good enough if I see it and I can use it for my purposes. But what's called Jewish art is not that. I mean, it's something, I mean, if you paint a Jewish scene of it, I guess like Chagall, who may have been at one time a real artist, maybe what he did later on was also sometimes real. But this confusion between the message and the client, the purpose, tends to devalue the spirit of the art. And what I'm interested in is that. I'm not interested so much in the history of the Kiddush cup, although I imagine that the Kiddush cup has a history, and that history is usually interesting. But I'm more interested in someone who would explain what the spirit of Kiddush is. What does it mean to announce that one state of being called Chol is ending and another state of being called Shabbos is beginning? If somebody could help me to connect to that idea, then I would feel good about it. That would be good for me. And if an artist can do it, then I think that's great. If that's Jewish art, then that's Jewish art.
final programming note. Thank you to those who have been listening along and sending in your comments. This will be this has been our eighth session. We're going to be taking a break for a few weeks for what we call here Bein Hazmanim, and we hope to return with new sessions hopefully at the beginning of September. In the meantime, I remind you of our new text resource, a new print resource, which is an annotated bibliography and a downloadable library of essays, all in Ivrit, that deal with Rav Kook's appreciation for, approach to, and understanding of art. And that, of course, you can get to through our website.